Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 75, Morons in a Hurry. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell and I'm here this week with Jonathan Askin, Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the Brooklyn Law School. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show. Folks, I've known Jonathan for a long time. He's a wonderful thinker and policy wonk, if you don't mind my calling you that.
Where I come from, that's a badge of honor.
Yes, exactly. On all things related to technology law and policy. Former lawyer for the FCC. I should have a page somewhere that is the PR page for TWiL that tells people certain guidelines and absolutes, one of which is if you design a thought piece on technology law or policy around a Star Wars metaphor, I'm going to ask you to be on TWiL. And that's what Jonathan did this week at TechCrunch. So we're going to have a little net neutrality conversation with him. Wherein we consider whether Anakin is being lured to the dark side by the evil empire Verizon and which side is winning. So also with us is Evan Brown from internetcases.com in Chicago. Hi, Evan.
Hello. Happy Friday. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back and happy Friday to you.
Yes. Thank you.
Evan Sandoval, the media maverick from CNET. Greg, are you with us? No, not quite. Okay, well, the studio will advise me when Greg has joined us. We do expect him, but he's going to be audio only with us today. So, Jonathan, let's launch off with your piece on poor Anakin being lured to the dark side. How is it that Google is being pulled that way by, goodness, I hope Verizon's not its father.
Yeah. Well, I should actually preface this by telling you I'm a fraud when it comes to my Star Wars knowledge. I'm certainly, I love speculative fiction. I love science fiction. I always consider myself much more of a Star Trek fan than a Star Wars fan. Star Wars to me is just, you know, action shoot-ups in the sky. And doesn't really delve into interesting speculative fiction issues for me, but I thought the analogy was apropos.
Yes.
So I did. If there was a Star Trek analogy, I would have preferred to have done that. So the question is, how has Google perhaps moved over to the dark side?
Yes, exactly. Why don't you just, you know, we've tried to unpack the whole net neutrality state of the union over the last several shows on TWiL and have tried to figure out exactly what's going on and what this policy statement between Verizon and Google actually means and what sort of impact this kind of thing can have in Washington. So why don't you give us your thoughts on those points?
Well, the first thing we have to recognize is that the strategists at Google may be more brilliant than any of us. So it's quite possible they're just they are functioning like chess grandmasters and are playing about 10 moves ahead of the rest of us and actually knew that there would be a backlash against Google for its appearance to have gone over to the side of the internet access providers like Verizon and Comcast and AT&T. It's also possible that Google genuinely thought it was brokering a decent deal for itself and perhaps for the other internet application companies out there. But the bottom line is Google has been heavily involved pretty much before any other internet company in tech policy, telecom, internet policy in DC, and has been, in my mind, the leading light for technology policy and open internet for the past 6 years or so. So it was surprising to a lot of us who have been, I guess, sitting in the ivory tower and watching from the sidelines as the DC policy brokers start to negotiate the right structure, the right policy framework to allow access to the internet by consumers. So Google was always, I thought, for many years, working lockstep with the rest of the internet application companies to ensure an open internet, to ensure that those that provide access, the few carriers that actually provide the pipes, wireless or wired pipes to everyone's home, to make sure that every single user can fairly reach the internet without the gatekeeper, the Verizons and Comcast and AT&Ts of the world, telling the user what they can do with their internet experience. Now, having said that, there was about 2 years ago, the FCC auctioned off a huge swath of wireless spectrum in the 700 megahertz frequency. I'm sure some of your listeners are well aware of that issue. There was talk that Google was going to bid on that frequency. If you think about what Google is an internet company with lots of servers out there and lots of great applications on the internet, but they don't actually control the access to each end user. So there were some that thought that, well, Google still needs Verizon and AT&T and Comcast in order to reach the end user. Maybe Google will step up and try to obtain licenses for this frequency in the auction process so that it wouldn't always be beholden to Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and Cablevision and the other access providers. Now, Google did not get any winning bids in that auction. So Google still has no last mile access to users except to use someone else's pipe or to use Wi-Fi or, you know, wireless broadband, what have you. So Google, like the rest of the internet companies, is looking for its way to ensure guaranteed access to users. Now, one way they're doing this is they're doing business deals with Verizon in particular to make sure that its services function well on the Verizon wireless network. You see that with the new droids coming out, the Androids, et cetera. And you see it now, Google Voice is actually embedded in the new Androids on the Verizon network. So they're working in a business context with Verizon pretty significantly now. Now that's bled over into the policy arena, where Google and Verizon have at least stepped up and tried to tell the world and the FCC in particular that they think they have the compromise that will ensure enough of an open internet, but still give the access providers, Verizon and AT&T and Comcast, enough control over the networks to ensure quality provisioning of internet services. That's essentially where we stand right now. And now we're all looking at the Verizon-Google deal and trying to determine whether or not this is actually a brokered compromise that is somewhat painful for access providers and somewhat painful for internet application providers, but ultimately in the best interest of consumers. I'm very skeptical about that. I believe that the Google Verizon deal misses several huge holes that you could essentially, slip a managed service YouTube video through that only Google and Verizon can control. And everyone else that wants to provide a Google-like service, be it video or voice or other application, won't have the same rights as Google to reach end users. Denise, is that a decent overview there? I may have gone on a little bit long.
No, absolutely. And we appreciate that. I want to check and see. I think we have Greg on the line with us now. Greg, are you with us?
I'm here.
Yay, hello. So welcome, Greg Sandoval, the media maverick from CNET. We're in the midst of a discussion of net neutrality and Jonathan Askin's post. Jonathan's on with us this week over on TechCrunch called, wonderful title, Google is Anakin, Verizon is the Emperor, and the Dark Side is Winning. So Jonathan just gave us a good overview on where things stand and the back and forth and the context of this Google Verizon policy statement they put out. Jonathan, a follow-up question on that. Have you ever seen anything like this before where a couple of companies would get together and pen a letter that sort of is their personal view on how the law should go and send it off to the FCC and expect it to have some impact? And if you have seen something like this before, does it have an impact?
Absolutely. It happens quite often. Very often, the FCC is in the middle of a quandary between the industry. It wants to broker a deal that causes some agitation to all the players, but ultimately is in the best interest of consumers. So normally, the FCC sends a signal to the industry saying, look, you folks better bang your heads together and come up with a compromise solution, or we're going to do something and you don't know what the hell we're going to do, and it may end up being devastating for all of you. So it's a little bit like AAA arbitration, where everyone has to sort of bite the bullet a little bit and accept a little bit of pain in the ultimate best interest, or the FCC is going to have to itself figure out what is ultimately in the best interest, and it might not be in the best interest of your company. We've seen this over the past, since passage of the 96 Telecom Act. You've seen long-distance providers and local providers try to broker deals and present deals to the FCC as a seeming compromise. The problem is, and you see this, I think, very starkly in the Google-Verizon situation, is that it's very easy for the largest player in the internet sphere and the largest player in the access sphere to come together and come up with a solution that kind of works for both of them, but really doesn't necessarily help all of the smaller players, traveling around and who will ultimately be either benefited or aggrieved by the compromise. So has Google struck a deal that works for itself? Probably. Has Google struck a deal that works for every other would-be Google out there, or every other kid with a great application idea running out of a barn in, Palo Alto? Probably not. If you think about what the Google-Verizon deal does, it doesn't do two things. It doesn't apply to wireless. And I think it's no surprise to any of us that wireless is where Verizon and Google and virtually every other player is resting its revenue streams in the future. Mobility is where it's at. Mobile broadband is where we're moving to. If the net neutrality compromise only applies to tethered wireline services, that's a legacy application that essentially does not contemplate the need for open access in the wireless realm. That's one point. Point number two is the Google-Verizon compromise says in very vague terms that the compromise still allows the access providers to provide managed services and to avoid net neutrality principles if they are providing what's called managed services. So what does that mean? We don't really know. There's no definitional oomph to what they mean by managed services. And it essentially allows Verizon and Google, Verizon in particular, to say, we need to manage this service, and therefore you, company Y, cannot get the same access to our consumers as company Z can. And maybe company Z happens to be Google providing a streaming YouTube video. And company Y, which can't get the same access, is another company that wants to provide a streaming Hulu. Now, Hulu is probably not a great example because they have a lot of power too, but it's a YouTube wannabe. Someone that wants to provide something the equivalent of a YouTube streamed offering, but doesn't have the same deal with Verizon. And Verizon says, well, because of managed services, we're not going to allow you the same access that will allow this streamed YouTube video.
Right. So some people are upset that the way that this is unfolding, the way the pro-net neutrality forces are proceeding here, is not to go forth and ask Congress to legislate something, but they are approaching the FCC as if they are the body that is the be-all and end-all of how this policy and legal principles, precedents, etc., should unfold. Do you see anything strange about that strategy? And what do you think the FCC will do now that it has Google and Verizon's statement?
Yeah. Well, I think that's absolutely the right strategy for the internet application providers out there. I've seen this all too often. I used to be a lobbyist for first the competitive telecom providers trying to compete against the old line Bell network, and then with the internet startup companies trying to compete against the behemoths out there on the internet and the broadband providers. Now, what happens every time something goes to Congress? What happens? The most powerful interests almost always prevail. Congress is not the place for these smaller players who do not have the money, the resources, the know-how to lobby in the corridors of power, especially in the House of Representatives. Where's the power at the House of Representatives? The power comes from giving campaign contributions, significant contributions, and having hundreds of lobbyists working the floors of Congress every single day. Small internet startups don't have the resources, except for Google and a few of the other, largest players. So they can't really walk Congress and explain in lucid, clear terms to Congress, the same way the lobbying machinery of the phone networks, the cable companies, and now Google can lobby Congress. So I've become a bit jaded by the congressional process, and I'm sort of more of a technocrat at this point. I think that five independent, arguably independent voices at the FCC can come up with a fairer perspective, as long as they're not essentially beholden to the whip of Congress or the executive branch, that they can come up with something without having to be concerned about lining the their campaign coffers for their next election season. So, five independent voices at the FCC, three Democrats and two Republicans. I would put more stock in their ability to come up with a compromise that is ultimately in the best interest of the American consumers.
Did they have the authority to do that in the wake of the Comcast decision earlier this year?
Well, that's debatable. And frankly, that's not the fault of this FCC. Over the past 8 years, for those who aren't familiar with the Comcast decision, over the past 8 years, the FCC in the Bush years played what I call a definitional shell game. They redefined telecommunications services and essentially said that any broadband service used to reach the internet is not a telecom service and is not subject to common carrier oversight. Well, so the FCC essentially relinquished the authority that Congress had given it to it pursuant to the Communications Act to oversee to guarantee open networks and to guarantee common carrier regulation, to guarantee non-discrimination on broadband networks. The only place the FCC now arguably has the authority to ensure non-discrimination, to ensure common carrier oversight, is in what's left of the narrowband voice communications network. Those copper lines that we use when we pick up an old handset, which in 10 years may be completely non-existent. So the FCC's dilemma right now is to figure out, I think, how to reassert the common carrier oversight over America's future communications network, the broadband pipes, wireless and wireline broadband pipes. To me, these are the paradigmatic examples of a common carrier network, of common carriage. If you look at the history of common carriage dating back from canals and railroads and roads and stagecoaches and telegraph and telephony, the network of the future is the broadband network. And if that's not subject to common carriage oversight, I don't know what should be subject to common carrier oversight. So my thought is the FCC can probably redefine the broadband networks back into the realm of a telecom service subject to common carrier oversight without congressional input. If we get forced to go to Congress, it's going to take 10 years for Congress to do anything. And frankly, Congress is still going to be beholden to the largest lobbying interests out there and will give the FCC a mandate that won't necessarily adequately consider the common carrier obligations and the best interests of captive consumers.
Greg, do you consider the net neutrality issue a partisan one? Do you think this is one that we'll see come up in the 2012 elections or even elections later on this year?
Well, I would like to hope that somebody cares about this enough to make it a serious issue. That protest that they had at Google wasn't all that well populated, so I'd hope people would take the time and find out what the issues are and stand up. Sometimes I think it's a big deal. Some of these issues come up and they're a big deal to us, right? We're immersed in technology and mainstream America just doesn't care, just doesn't know. So I hope so.
Yeah, I read a piece that was trying to cast it that way, that, you know, the pro net neutrality forces are sort of the Berkeley left and the anti ones are big business interests, et cetera. And I don't know if I buy into that necessarily. Although they did cite that the Gun Owners of America had formerly signed on as supporters of net neutrality, and they have recently withdrawn. So, you know, if the gun owners aren't for it, then I guess the political right can't be. Evan, what
Denise,
do you think?
Can I add to that?
Sure, please.
Jonathan.
Yes.
That's a new development. That is, to my mind, a new marketing. Let's draw up the sides. When net neutrality mm-hmm. first became an issue, there were advocates on both sides of the aisle supporting net neutrality. You saw the bills coming through. You saw in the Commerce Committee in both the Senate and the House, advocates on both sides supporting net neutrality. And it was primarily from advocates who believed in the power of the internet and also believed in the power of small independent entrepreneurs. I frankly would love to see the small business committees in the House and the Senate get more heavily involved in that. Now, that to me is not a Democrat or Republican issue, but it's both. It's anyone who believes in free enterprise and ensuring the rights of small businesses to be able to reach consumers in the most robust way possible. And to me, that means the open internet. So I frankly would think you'd see a lot of free market Republicans embracing something akin to net neutrality to make sure that all of the small businesses in America can essentially do their business without being captive to the, you know, monopolist behemoths that are Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T.
Evan, can you think of ways in which big business, conservative, traditional, political right interests would benefit from net neutrality?
Wow.
Drop a bomb on you there.
Right. Well, I was thinking of it more in terms of the small business owner, the small to mid-level entrepreneurs. I mean, those are the kind of people that I represent, and that's why I come down on the side of network neutrality and would see that more as, a side that traditionally the Republicans would take, you know, the less government involvement. Well, that's one thing that's really ironic about all of this is that, you know, the network neutrality really means hands off, but there's a lot of government involvement to ensure that is. So, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as big businesses, benefiting from network neutrality, it seems like there's something that's inherent about the openness of the internet and having more participants on there. If you have more people on the network consuming content, wanting to, you certainly are always going to have a small community of developers. And if that is going to, that community of developers would seem to comprise the ecosystem, which is going to keep the whole system robust and data flowing through it and people interested and, spending time online for entertainment and commerce and to gather information, doing that rather than, being offline, doing something like that. So as far as answering that question, that was that bomb that you just dropped on me. I mean, that's my best attempt at an abstract answer. We could certainly pontificate a little bit more, and I'm sure Jonathan and Greg have some ideas as well. But my knee-jerk reaction is to see it more from the perspective that I see it in my everyday practice with clients who are out there struggling, trying to do something cool. The benefits of the open network, for them, I don't think of it in terms of the benefits of the Googles and the Verizons of the world.
Yeah, I guess my sort of unformed thought on that was if we view the internet as simply a transport layer, then it's in everybody's interest for that transport layer to work as efficiently as possible. That's just sort of a broad assertion.
And something that is interesting to me, and I've brought this up in episodes in the past, I'm really intrigued by this notion of these managed services, which, has been the subject of criticism, saying, well, this is going to be an end run around network neutrality. I really think it's interesting to consider what kind of really innovative things could come about within the context of a managed service that would not be subject to the strictures of network neutrality. I realize that it's easy to get frightened by something, especially if one comes to the question as a proponent of network neutrality and realizing the benefits of it. But there really could be some neat things that could be operating outside of the internet, but which would have all the hallmarks and attributes of what we have come to think of as internet type of communications and interactions. So but I don't know. I just don't know how afraid to be of this managed services stuff yet.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, are you afraid?
I am afraid, and I'm afraid because it's just too large a loophole. If you look historically at what companies like Verizon and AT&T have done on the wireless network, you remember when Verizon first launched its EVDO, its early wireless broadband network. Their terms of service precluded you from running any alternative voice application on the network under the guise that an alternative voice network was going to use up too much bandwidth and would preclude other users from using the wireless network. A voice network, a narrow voice channel. It said nothing about video. Now, why would Verizon say something like that? They would say something like that because where did their core revenue come from in their wireless network? It came from voice minutes. So if anyone is going to be able to offer an alternative voice application to the Verizon mobile voice service, that was going to cut severely into Verizon's revenue stream on its EVDO, on its wireless through EVDO. Now, to me, that is so disingenuous. And I think that will be the mindset going forward. You don't say, under the guise that it's going to use up too much bandwidth, you can't run this narrow alternative voice channel. The truth of the matter is you can't run this narrow voice channel because it's going to cut into our core revenue stream. When Wi-Fi first came out and phones were capable of running Wi-Fi, AT&T precluded all of its phones from having Wi-Fi capabilities. I had to go to Stockholm to get my phone because I wanted a phone with Wi-Fi on it so I could have alternative voice services. So I could run Skype on my phone at a time when AT&T said, no, you can't use Skype on our network because we want to make sure we get all our revenue off of selling a wireless voice bundles. You see it now with the AT&T Apple situation and their reluctance, their refusal to allow things like Google Voice and Skype to run on their network. It's only because Verizon and Google are now working hand in hand, that you now see the ability to run Skype and Google Voice applications on the Verizon network. But to say, to say that Verizon and AT&T and Comcast can self-determine what is a managed service, to me, is absolutely akin to letting the fox guard the chicken coop. I think there needs to be some regulatory oversight or at least some input, definitional input from those in the application world who want to run services over the wireless network.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg, do you think that it's a little bit weird, given that we were talking about this right before we started to record, given that Google and Verizon have made this statement, that Google just announced this week that they are going into the voice phone call business?
It would look pretty coincidental, right? But Google is so big. And there's so many different divisions. It is very possible that it is just a coincidence that they did it. Now, that said, people can look at it and say, isn't that good for Google? Isn't that nice that Google has got these going at the same time that they're cutting these deals or at least making these arrangements and agreements with these ISPs? So I think someone else has said that earlier, Evan said it earlier, that Google made a deal or a plan or is hopefully laying the groundwork for a plan that's going to be beneficial to it in the long run. I don't think we should be surprised about that.
Yeah. Now, on that point, when I was trying to use the new Google Voice application through my Google Chat on my Verizon Droid phone, and I couldn't figure out how to do it on the mobile network. I could do it on my my laptop through my my Gmail, but I can't seem to figure out how to do it on my Gmail on my phone. And I don't know if that's calculated or it's just not, I just don't know how to do it yet. But to me, that's possibly an area where Verizon said, Google, all well and good that you have the voice running on Gmail. Let's just not jump in and allow it to work on the Verizon mobile network just yet.
Right. Let's leave it on those legacy wired connections.
Right.
Oh, someone, let's see. Goodness, I don't even know how to read this. Finkos Maximus in the chat room is saying that Google Voice isn't allowed on mobile, so that there was affirmative blocking, so he or she believes.
Well, I do have Google Voice on my Droid X. I haven't actually figured out how to fully use it. I know it exists there. It's not for the faint of heart or not for the serious tech savvy, and I don't know that it actually works on the traditional mobile voice platform, or if you actually need to run it over the Wi-Fi only. I suspect it has to run over the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that would make sense. Okay, well, let's get on to this other article I stuck in the links from American Chronicle called "Is It Legal?" Talking about the pending privacy legislation and basically people's complaints about it from both sides. Jonathan, do you think that this is going anywhere, or will this be yet another privacy bill that languishes because no one can agree on how it should work?
I think if anyone can pull this deal off, it's Rick Boucher. They've been trying every single term for the past 10 years to come up with new privacy legislation. I think we're about due for it. Now, the FTC has come out with its privacy guidelines. I think now Congress can sort of see what the FTC has done and could color it and come up with some broad principles. The fact that everyone on both sides seems critical of the current draft legislation makes me think they're probably doing something right, and we probably have enough momentum now to have a sophisticated dialogue on the Hill. And frankly, I think if Rick Boucher is bringing in all sides on this issue, something can really happen that adequately balances the needs of emerging online companies and the needs of the need to protect the privacy interests of Americans. So I think we're moving in the right direction. I think having it out there as a model for us to criticize is probably the right first step.
Great. Greg, what do you think of Diaspora? Do you think that is going to be the solution, there's a private way to manage one's data that keeps it out of the control of third-party services and under the control of the users?
When it comes to this kind of thing, I'm extreme in protecting people's privacy. These issues, I hear people say, oh, there's nothing to be worried about. I hear Eric Schmidt saying, well, you shouldn't be doing certain things if you're worried about them. I believe we have the right to use the net. I believe we have the right to be protected from people looking at our stuff. This is the kind of thing that you don't know you need it until something bad happens. So whatever the efforts are by the Congress right now, and as they take a look and they want to protect business companies and they want to be able to make it so that they can still do business, I say err on the side of caution. We're still at the infancy of the Internet, and let's make it as safe as possible for users.
Denise?
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
In the interest of... In order to comply with the FTC disclosure guidelines, I've got to let you and your audience know that my students and I actually represent the diaspora kids.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
You do. That's very interesting.
Yeah. The idea grew out of a discussion we had at NYU back in the spring, in which Eben Moglen from Columbia gave a call to arms and said, folks, let's go out there and create the Freedom Box. A box where we are not going to be beholden to the Facebook and Google overlords who will control our privacy, control our logs, control our intellectual property. We have the technology to go out there. So you kids go out and start coding right now and create something that will allow you, the user, to control your own user logs and create a social network that will allow for the user to control it and not be stuck with the potential benevolent despotism of a Facebook overlord. So Diaspora kids went out, they coded, they've been spending the entire summer coding, and they're about to come back, I hope, with something that looks like a great alternative, a user-empowered alternative to Facebook.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Great. I was wondering what you did in your clinical law work, so that's good to know. And we're really looking forward to seeing what they come up with. That's certainly...
You know that Mark Zuckerberg gave them a contribution as well.
I did know that. Yes.
Yes.
So good for Mark. Good right. PR move.
I don't know if it's a PR stunt or what. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, so they've raised quite a lot of money, haven't they?
So they went out to Kickstarter. Their goal was $10,000 so that they wouldn't mm-hmm. have to work for the summer. They treated it like it was a summer internship. They got $200,000. Over $200,000.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah. It's a blessing and a curse. They now they have an obligation to produce something.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. We're glad they're motivated, and we look forward to what they come up with. And certainly would love to have you back when that is out and having its tires kicked around so we can talk about how it works and what's great about it and maybe what's not. So let's stick to privacy for a moment. Of course, Facebook had a big announcement and more controversy. Are they ever able to announce a new service without controversy? About places and the fact that you can tag your friends who maybe don't want to be outed for where they are. Evan, have you looked at this? And you know, we keep coming back to these locational services. It was only a matter of time till Facebook did something. What are your takes on this launch and how it has unfolded so far?
I think you very accurately observed that there is seldomly a launch of a new feature in Facebook that is not accompanied with a certain amount of controversy, and it's not too hard to figure out that that's probably just part of Facebook's MO with this to launch these things with a certain amount of controversy that might translate into fanfare for a certain way. So there's really nothing surprising about the confusion that seems to be arising here. There was this article in our show notes for today, you know, on TechCrunch by Jason Kincaid that talked about the confusing stages of opting in. And nothing too surprising about it, because the complaint to me seems to be here is that you really have a hard time opting out, and you're kind of involved. Your friends can check you into places even before you have a chance of doing anything about it. So clearly the, what I imagine would be the normal course of events here is that someone sees that they're unwittingly involved with Facebook places and, have to take some quick steps to remove themselves from it here. I haven't watched the video that Facebook posted kind of explaining it. That would probably be helpful to do. But, this is all just part of a pattern of Facebook launches and features going all the way back to, it's hard to believe now that the news stream was controversial back in 2006 or 2007. And then, of course, Beacon was controversial, and then all the various updates to their privacy policy. So continuing a trend, and I don't see anything odd about it. It's something, it's a little blip that will be corrected here as people get a better understanding for it.
Right.
That's what I think.
I don't know if this is related or not, but they bought a little company that I was playing around with that I think is going to shut its doors soon, that was called Next Trip, I believe. And it was a way of, if you're going to go on a trip, you can map out your agenda and then people can chime in. And if you've never been there before, they can tell you where you should go. So sort of future location-based information. Right. Yeah. I don't know if that's going to tie in with that or not, but it seems like there could be a fit there. And also seems like somebody is giving Facebook good advice if they are giving money to the diaspora folks. And I noticed that they had, at least over at the AFF, when they commented on the release of places and, talked about its various privacy implications and how one should use it, and tried to educate people about, the opting out issue. They said that Facebook had been consulting with EFF along the way and getting a lot of feedback before they launched. So EFF said it wasn't, not all of their comments were incorporated, but that they were happy that they had this dialogue with Facebook about the product before it came out, which is a positive thing. Greg, do you have any thoughts about this?
No, just other than that, it's good to get EFF and other groups involved in this thing and take a leadership approach. If you're Facebook and you know that you're going to run into this, no matter what you do, you're going to have these problems. I think it's great, and whether Mark is being self-serving or not by giving money, it shows that he's putting his money in the right place, right? He's given both sides a chance to voice their concerns. And I think it's a great thing to do, but we're still at the beginning of the internet. We don't know everything that can happen. I think we should watch ourselves. Everyone should watch themselves online and not take it for granted that Mark Zuckerberg or AT&T or Comcast are going to take care of us. We've seen that they won't, or at least the ISPs, and that they won't take care of us automatically.
No. Jonathan, do you think that this issue of location-based services and pinpointing people's location is much on the radar of tech and policy lawmakers in Washington?
I think it's more and more so. Was it today the Ninth Circuit just came out with a decision determining it's okay to put for the police officers to put GPS tracking devices on people's cars without their knowledge?
I think it was a while ago, actually.
I think this is the next case that's going to the Supreme Court, because here in New York, you can't do that. In D.C., you can't do it. In California, apparently you can. I think it's It's decisions like that that are now placing the issue squarely on the minds of legislators and at the FCC and FTC. I think, you know, the issue for me becomes, at what point does Facebook become so sticky and such a powerful network of networks that it supplants the historic networks that we've relied upon? And does it become something that looks like a public good? You've seen over the past 2 or 3 years, Facebook experiment with its privacy settings. And each time there's been a backlash. 2 years ago, it would have been very simple for people to extricate themselves from the Facebook network. It wasn't that sticky. You maybe didn't have that many friends on it. You still had your phone network. You still had other potential social networks. You still had your friends on AIM. Now that it's snowballed to the extent where so much of your life is on Facebook, frankly, I think government has to start taking a critical look. People may think I'm over-regulatory or, you know, screaming, you know, the sky is falling. But at some point, when we are all on Facebook and Facebook becomes the default communications network of the future, should the FCC start to look at it as a real communications platform subject to things like common carrier oversight, you know, akin to what we had with the AT&T network back in the days of the Bell monopoly?
Right. Yeah, that's a fascinating point, and I think we're headed in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there are two ways to resolve it. Either you regulate it like a regulated monopoly, or you require mandatory interconnect and the ability for people to take their identity off of Facebook and transplant it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if Facebook is so large and so powerful that the only way you can communicate with your friends is if you're actually on Facebook, it does no good if you say, well, forget it. I don't like their new privacy settings. I don't like that they can geo-track me everywhere. I'm going to MySpace, or I'm going to, you know, to Orkut or some other social network. Because you all of a sudden you go to MySpace, well, all your friends are on Facebook. Unless Facebook has an agreement to interconnect with all your MySpace people, then it really does you no service to get off of Facebook. And it's way too sticky. And we're seeing that stickiness grow and grow and grow, and Facebook expressing more and more power as it reduces our privacy.
Yeah. Evan, are you on Facebook against your will at this point, simply because it's where you need to be?
No, I like it. I enjoy it for, you know, what it is. And you know, I'm just very judicious about what I put up there. I mean, I've got a lot of friends that cross different strata of my life, you know, all the way back from childhood friends to clients. So, you know, I'm just very conscientious of the content, and I honestly just don't worry about it a whole lot for whatever reason. Maybe I should listen to Greg more and be more, you know, uptight about these things. But you know, I'm just not. As an aside, it looks like there was a Ninth Circuit opinion that just came out either today or yesterday about GPS. I didn't know about it, but it's what Jonathan mentioned.
There is
a big split in the circuits here. I know the Seventh Circuit allows them. There was the D.C. Circuit a couple weeks ago, and then it looks
that's
like the Ninth Circuit.
That's what I was thinking of. Yep.
But anyway, I don't want to take us off of what we were talking about here with privacy and Facebook and stuff. So I know Greg was wanting to chime in with what I was saying.
No, I was just saying you should be as paranoid as I am, and I'll tell you, maybe it's not the best thing to announce, but I am not on Facebook. I guess I'm maybe from a generation that values the privacy. And I was on it different times. I stuck my head or foot, a toe into it. And each time I had a problem. You know, somebody saw some pictures of a friend, you know, ex-girlfriend, that kind of thing. Or some people would post something on the wall. You know, my bosses are on the wall. all this stuff. My sources. How about this? A source. Communicated with me. They didn't realize, you know, it just turned out to be kind of scary to me. Maybe I'll go back to it. But at this point, I'm not on it because I do have value in my privacy.
Greg, I wish I had your courage to abandon the Facebook sandbox. We had Dump Facebook Day over the summer and almost no one did it. Me among them. I also consider myself on the fringe of the privacy fanatics. And at this point, it's too much of my communication has to exist on Facebook.
I keep telling myself that I actually know how to use it, and I've figured out the privacy settings, and so I'm in control and can make sure that those kinds of situations don't arise. But Greg, as you point out, sometimes it's not what you have control over, it's what somebody else does because they don't understand the context and where information is flowing. And every time I've thought I was in control, I learned something where I went, whoa, you know, I didn't know that that piece of data was going over there. So it's still just a bit of a morass, I think, but I'm still there. I find it really useful.
I like Twitter.
Twitter, I like Twitter too.
A little bit more control, right? There's only so much damage you can do with 140 characters. So.
Right, and everyone knows it's in public. There's not any confusion about that.
Except every typo, every misstatement you make is now held in posterity at the Library of Congress.
Yes, it is indeed. And I actually have a tip of the week for us on that in a bit. But as long as we're on Facebook, Evan, I think you sent me this story about Facebook deciding that they have the book ending extension, if you will. Let me try this again. That if your business ends in book, they're going to come after you. You want to tell us what's going on with that?
Yeah, there was a lawsuit filed either last week or the week before last. It's just now coming into the news again. It was filed out there in the Northern District of California, so I expect a very swift motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. It was a company here in my neck of the woods, I think up in Northbrook, which is a suburb of Chicago up north. It's a social networking site geared for educators, teachers, and students called TeachBook. And it's got two employees and I think 20 registered users. Probably has more users now that it's getting all this attention by being sued by Facebook. But Facebook's suing for trademark infringement, claiming that it's likely to cause confusion, because it's in such a close proximity in that space of the market, namely social networking sites. So it's one of those things where trademark law makes companies do strange things sometimes. I think if anybody is going to look at this very reasonably and employ that famous test of the moron in a hurry, they're going to see that a moron in a hurry is not going to confuse TeachBook with Facebook, not going to think that TeachBook is Facebook and vice versa. But here's where trademark law makes companies do strange things. There's this... it's an obligation, but it compels companies to be perhaps more assertive than what they really need to, because they want to avoid their mark being deemed abandoned or at least weakened in the marketplace. You know, one of the hallmarks of trademark protection is, you know, the distinctiveness of the trademark to represent the source of certain goods or services, and the more there are of similar marks out there in the marketplace, the less distinctive that becomes, and it weakens the trademark protection and all that stuff. So there's every good reason for companies to aggressively police their marks. But then again, reason cannot totally dismiss itself from this scenario. What is Facebook so worried about? I mean, it's Facebook, for crying out loud. It's the social networking site. Is it really concerned that it's going to lose market share to someone in a very niche space like this? It's very easy to lose sight of the overarching goals of trademark law, which really are consumer protection in their origin. You want to make sure that consumers aren't confused into thinking that services from one company are the services of another, or vice versa. So on balance, I think Facebook is being a little silly by filing this lawsuit, especially since making it such a David and Goliath kind of thing here. So I hope this goes away really soon, one way or the other.
Yeah, Facebook, phone book, that seems like a pretty generic term to begin with. I suppose it can lose its genericness by being used for the name of a very well-known business. But still, I mean, it just smacks me as a little strange. Anyone else feel that way?
Yeah, I think Facebook is in between a rock and a hard place on this. I think Facebook mm-hmm. has no choice but to vigilantly enforce its trademark where and whenever it can against whomever it can. They have an affirmative obligation so that they don't dilute it. Now, whether or not this one's borderline frivolous, that will be a judgment that the court will make. But I think, frankly, if I was their attorney, and I'm not a big advocate for, rigorous enforcement of intellectual property, but I think they have an obligation not to allow their trademark to get watered down. So I think they probably did the right thing, whether or not they succeed or not.
Yeah, I mean, I can see where you're coming from with that. But their trademark is Facebook. It's not book, right? So there's the iBook. There are all sorts of book things out there that, you know, are we going to see them aggressively going after? Who knows?
Well, they learn from Apple.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, the chat room has been kind of blowing up the whole time we've been talking by today's news that Paul Allen, a firm that he runs, is suing Apple, Google, and 9 other companies, alleging that they are violating patents developed at a lab financed by Mr. Allen more than a decade ago. I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal's coverage here, Dion Searcy. Let's see. The suit lists violations of 4 patents for technology that appear to be key components of the operations of the companies and that of e-commerce and internet search companies in general. The technology behind one patent allows a site to offer suggestions to consumers for items related to what they're currently viewing or related to online activities of others in the case of social networking sites. So the article goes on to point out it's kind of interesting that Microsoft and Amazon are not named in this suit, although, of course, they engage in various activities like this too. But included in the suit are AOL, eBay, Facebook, Netflix, Office Depot, Office Max, Staples, Yahoo, and of course, Apple and Google. So this will be a fun one to watch. And thank you, IRC, for cluing us into it. Greg, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I've got thoughts. Paul Allen's technology investments were a complete wash and bust, and so he's trying to squeeze out as much money as he can anyway. this is going back now a decade. It sounds pretty frivolous to me, like it doesn't have a chance, but I obviously haven't seen the litigation. He is known
as the patents.
Exactly. But it's the company, it's funny that the company that owned the patents is now defunct. I'm just saying, did not have a great record investing in tech.
Well, maybe he just sunk so much into SETI that this is where we're left. Jonathan, any thoughts on Paul Allen going crazy with his patents here?
Well, I haven't seen the patents, but I'd be curious to see whether or not they survive post-Bilski scrutiny.
Right.
I assume these are all essentially software patents, not tethered to any particular hardware. And we have yet to see how the courts will interpret the Supreme Court's decision in Bilski as it applies to these sorts of software patents.
Right. That will be interesting. Since the court pretty much left it, we're going to take it case by case. This could be an interesting one to unpack those principles. So let's see. Greg, we haven't had you on the show for a while, and you walk the media beat, the entertainment, music, movie, et cetera, beat. Why don't you tell us if there's anything interesting going on there right now that you're working on or have been working on the last week or so?
Well, I think that's something that's timely that's happening. Everybody's waiting for Apple to come up with a new cloud music service. And people are speculating whether it could happen in September 1st. Apple has called a press conference for that day. My source is saying that it's not going to happen. But what's interesting is that my source in the music industry says that Apple has not communicated to them about any big streaming, you know, the cloud, storing your music on their servers and then being able to listen and get to it through any web-enabled device. They're saying they haven't communicated. But here's the rub here. A company by the name of MP3 Tunes, run by Michael Robertson, a longtime tech entrepreneur, and a person who has tweaked the music industry now for over a decade. His MP3.com was the first challenge copyright. He has asserted for a long time that his company, his new company, MP3 Tunes, and Apple do not have to go to the music industry to obtain rights to distribute music that people have already bought. In other words, I bought songs on CDs, and I ripped them and I put them online. Then if I want MP3 Tunes or Apple to store them on their servers for me and then enable me to listen to it wherever I am, they don't have to get permission for that. We're going to start seeing that issue addressed, and the MP3 Tunes has been sued by EMI, the fourth largest major record label. But people are wondering if Apple wouldn't try this out now. If Apple couldn't release a service and just say, you know what, we don't need your permission, big music industry. We're going to do this. These people bought this music. We're going to distribute to them. I don't think they're going to do that. But it definitely, and every story I write about this, I always put in a sentence to cover myself, because they could. Mm-hmm. They alienate the music industry, but there is, it looks like there is reason. The law has not been covered. No one has challenged this yet. And if you ever listen to Michael Robertson talk, he makes some good points about why should people have to pay twice.
Well, that was the whole point of his MP3.com company way back when, right? That you already owned the music, so you can locker it in the cloud and we can deliver it to you. And he got his hat handed to him in the largest copyright judgment ever. I'm not sure if that still stands, but it was for a long time.
Yes, and the difference between now and then is that he actually had to make copies of people's songs. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't have the technology to do what they can do now. Like, he essentially can take search someone's hard drive and take a recording, that person's recording, and put it online. There's some discrepancy about the technology that the music industry has about that, but he doesn't really have to make new copies, right? The record industry said you cannot make a separate copy of a person's song and distribute that. That's right. They don't have the right to do that. But now he doesn't have to make that second copy. So is it still, does the music industry still have a hold of that music? That's those songs that people have already purchased. That's a question that we're going to see answered. Go ahead.
Well, how is what Apple's proposing to do different than being any ordinary webcaster that would be able to get the benefits of paying the, you know, the statutory royalties to SoundExchange? You know, like what Pandora would do. How is it technologically different? What Apple may have planned? This, I guess, it's all still hypothetical, as far as we know.
Right. We don't know exactly what Apple's going to do. Got to make that clear. But remember, Pandora does not give you music that's on order, on demand. Right? They play music they want to play, and Apple could potentially give you on demand music. You could hear your own music, any song you wanted to hear, any time you wanted to hear. And they would give it to you from their servers. So this wouldn't be like radio at all. This would be like your iTunes playing the song that you want to play. And Apple would give it to you from their servers. That's the difference.
So, okay, well,
isn't that what M Spot does right now?
That's right. And I want to say this very clearly. M Spot has got trouble coming. The major record labels are going to go after them. They're essentially asserting the same thing that Robertson is, that they don't have to do this. The music industry disagrees. So it's just a matter of time before we see M-Spot in trouble here.
How old is M-Spot? I haven't heard of that one before.
Yeah, they're brand new products. They're a couple of months they launched. I think it's in the last 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a resurrection of the desire to have all your music in the cloud, especially, you know, we were talking about how wireless is everywhere and the future. So having something on your computer or even on a small device that you take with you just isn't really enough anymore.
So put this issue in a broader context also, because to me, it's interesting. If Apple has the courage to take on the record labels in this instance, why doesn't it have the courage to take on AT&T in the context of the iPhone, the jailbroken iPhone? If you think about it, so one of the articles that you posted to the site, Denise, is about Apple precluding the jailbreaking of the iPhone. Now, frankly, it's probably, all other things being equal, forget about AT&T, Apple would want the iPhone to work across all carriers. So the only reason Apple doesn't want the iPhone to be jailbroken is because it doesn't want to hurt its partner, AT&T, right? So you would think it was AT&T that would be the one to say, you can't jailbroke it. We got the iPhone in AT&T. Let's not let it work on Verizon or T-Mobile, et cetera.
Issue of what you can run on it too, the applications. And Apple is a little bit persnickety about what those should be.
Well, that's just a matter of their proprietary control. They're wanting to control the entire ecosystem and extract every ounce of revenue they can from everything. But wouldn't it be great for them if they could offer the iPhone equally on AT&T and T-Mobile? And the only reason they don't do that is because AT&T says, no, we have a deal with you. But now that the 2 years are up, Apple shouldn't care that people can take their, you know, their phone and port it over to a T-Mobile network. It's only in AT&T's interest that that not be allowed. So it seems weird that I think iPhone would have the courage to take on the recording industry, but not the courage to take on AT&T.
Yeah, anybody have any thoughts on that? Mine is that Apple has a different agenda, or at least claims to have a different agenda, that, you know, maybe the competition between carriers isn't as great a priority as having the device work well and be free from viruses and all the other things that the scary Android marketplace might bring to you.
Well, I think we should point out again that Apple has not decided yet to take on, we don't know, to take on the record industry. But I was always under the impression that they said that they didn't want the jailbroken phones out there because they wanted to control the quality of the experience. Also, I just want to point out, when you take on AT&T, that's, you're taking on a behemoth, and the record labels are much smaller. So I can just point out that it'd be in for a tougher fight, I think, if Apple were to challenge AT&T.
Well, I have a good lead in here to our I have three resources of the week for us this week. One of them is a graphic called the Working in Music, the Flow of Rights and Royalties. This was posted over at Tech Dirt and in a post, The Insanity of Music Licensing. And this graphic is just incredible. I think it came from a company called PC Pro, perhaps. I'm not sure. But go take a look at the Tech Dirt post. It's just this labyrinthine flowchart of back and forth of music licensing. So if you really want to understand the issues behind what we've been talking about here and how Apple and MP3 Tunes and Mbox and everybody has to navigate these waters that Evan alluded to, go check out this graphic. It's absolutely mind and eye boggling.
Right, and the irony of it is that this graphic actually makes it simple. If you actually go to the Copyright Act and read sections 112 and 114, I mean, it's just really just ridiculous about how Byzantine they are. This graphic looks nice and simple. You can actually understand it by looking at it.
Right, exactly. But if you don't want to have to deal with the wide, wide world of music licensing, you just want to get your stuff for free, there is a new extension out there called Extension FM that is a Chrome extension that will comb through, and I guess there are lots of utilities that do this, but this is one I just read about recently, combs through the vast universe of MP3 files out there on the web and brings them together for you. You can make playlists, and apparently it also integrates with Last.fm. So Chrome FM or Extension FM is out there for you to check out. Maybe I should have you guys chime in real quickly on the legality of this sort of thing, both using it and producing it. Evan, what do you think about that?
Is it? I read the article about it. I didn't download and install the extension, but it does not download the file to your local machine, right?
It helps you locate MP3s.
And then it's up to you then to find it. And it's up to you. It's up to you then to download it.
I guess, or maybe stream it, or, you know, one way or another, it aggregates them for you and makes them both discoverable and usable.
Right.
So, which otherwise they might not be. And I guess there's no guarantee how long they're going to stay out there on the web if people are out there fly swatting their works.
Right. Yeah, I'm not real concerned about it being, infringing or contributing to infringement here, because it seems like under the Sony test, it's something that's capable of a substantial non-infringing use. I mean, obviously, we all know that most people are going to be looking for copyrighted music, and a lot of the instances will be infringements. But, you know, there are an awful lot of MP3 files out there that one will ordinarily come across that are not infringing, you know, old recordings or things that are in the public domain, a lot of U.S. government stuff. You know, there's a wonderful repository of stuff made available. So, yeah, I think this is I think this sounds like a neat thing. I wouldn't worry too much about it. I mean, what the individual user can do to infringe is another separate question, but sounds pretty cool.
Yep. And then our final resource of the week is Google's new movies category. So I'm sorry, YouTube's new movies category. Maybe there's no real sense in making that distinction. But if you go to youtube.com/movies, there's a bunch of full-length, independent, licensed films for you to watch. And, you know, they're not anywhere near new release. They're not even as current as things in Netflix's Watch Instantly. But it's nice to see this sort of thing coming online. And they've got the Three Stooges and Abbott and Costello and Speed Racer. So I'm all for it. And thought you guys might also appreciate knowing that it's out there. Finally, I have a tip of the week, and that is that Google has launched its real-time search that it's had in beta for a while. And there are some, of course, it includes Twitter. And let me see, the Twitter archive, though, only goes back to, I believe, February of this year. And then, Jonathan, you referred earlier to the Library of Congress archiving Twitter further back than that. But until I read about this, let's see, and it's from Resource Shelf, I wasn't aware that no one is going to have access to the Library of Congress Twitter archive, that it's accessible only to Library of Congress staff for internal use only. And then there's limited public display, and you have to, you know, basically get some kind of permit to be able to access this stuff if you're there at the Library of Congress doing research, which was not how I understood this was going to work. So I guess it's a tip on two fronts, that Google has its real-time search, and don't be thinking you're going to have this, you know, wonderful searchable archive of the world of Twitter back to 2006, because apparently that's not the case. Any thoughts on this, Jonathan?
Well, frankly, I'm a little bit relieved. I was afraid. Yeah. In 2006, when I had two friends on Twitter, we were using Twitter just to send direct message, you know, messages, not using direct messages, just saying where we were. And I didn't want that forever in posterity for people to search me and find the nonsense I was saying on Twitter in 2006. So that's actually a bit of a relief to me to hear that it's actually not all searchable.
I'll take the other point. I'll take the other side of that.
All right.
This is a government organization. The Library of Congress works for us, right? It should be accessible to every taxpayer, every citizen. Why isn't this a database that we can all draw onto? And I'm sure there's all kinds of social studies that you can do and important information you can glean from this information. We should have it. We should have access.
I would tend to agree.
Well, I agree with that, except to anything that predates the decision to allow all of this information onto into the archives in the Library of Congress. I would say let the people know from here on end, this is all publicly searchable. This is, you know, a record of American information flow dating from 2009
there you go.
Forward.
All right. Sorry, I was talking over you there, Jonathan. I'm having a little Skype issue on my end. And it's also time for us to wrap the show. So I want to thank you all so much for coming on with us today. It was a great panel. Jonathan, keep up your good work there at the Brooklyn School of Law. And we hope to have you back again soon.
Great. I loved it.
Anything you want to plug before we sign off here?
No, let's to all of the folks out there with great ideas and running internet applications, don't forget to become a political force in Washington. To the extent that you folks have great ideas and need some pro bono legal support, consider and you're pushing the envelope at the intersection of technology and law, consider using me and my students. That's it.
Wonderful. And folks can follow Jonathan on Twitter. He's at Jay Askin. So thanks so much. And Greg, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, even by phone, and hope you get your Skype issues sorted out again soon, because we'd love to have you live in color and in moving video at some point.
Anytime.
All right. And Greg, of course, is the Media Maverick over at CNET and Sando CNET on Twitter. Then we've got Evan Brown. Evan, thanks so much again for coming on Twill. This is our... Is it your silver anniversary, number 75?
I think, well, it could be. I was first on Twill 18, I think. And I know that we've been doing mm-hmm. video since like Twill 23. So I think we've lost track. It's been great. And I know that we started about a year ago doing it every week, right? So
yes. Yes,
awesome.
Happy
time.
75th.
Yes, same to you. Great job. This is you're doing some awesome work, Denise. Really, really love being on it. So thanks for having me back week after week. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great, as always, to have you. Evan, of course, is at internetcases.com and internetcases on Twitter. And with that, we will see you folks next week, live at 11 o'clock Friday, live.twit.tv. Thanks for watching Twill.